It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello again. Today is the last interview of these in-between series specials. However, it's also the first episode of our early medieval journey. This episode and our next episode are two high-level introductions to the period, the themes and reputation of the period, which will be our home for the next 17 or so shows. Our guest today is David Petts. As you'll hear, David Petts' interests are wide and varied, but he primarily focuses on the early medieval period of northeast England. For fans of The Last Kingdom, this is the region dominated by Bebbanburg, as we call it today, Bamborough, a vast fortress looking out towards the foam-flecked grey waters of the North Sea and the storm-battered holy island called Lindisfarne. That same region is also where the cathedral and university city of Durham sits, in the sharp bend of the River Wear. David Petts is an associate professor at Durham University, which is where we met. David Petts was a constant presence in the lecture hall when I was studying for my bachelor's in archaeology. During that time, he was a warm and friendly presence. I remember one time in my second year, in the preparatory lectures for our third year dissertations, David Petts describing himself as a teddy bear, and then reminding us that not all professors will be so indulgent of our terrible grammar, so we best sharpen up. David's insistence on high standards while still being all smiles is what has made him a regular feature on British television, reporting on his excavations first at Binchester Roman Fort, and more recently, the holy island of Lindisfarne. It's also what has made him such a marvellous guest. That warm personality and sharp mind allowed us to cover a vast range of topics, and quite honestly, the only reason I closed the interview when I did was that we both had to go and have our dinner. Somewhat confusingly though, this last interview in this run of specials was the first interview I ever did. I was excited to dive into the early medieval period, and unlike Heather and Ed, I already had an established relationship with David Petts, so there was little back and forth around explaining who I was, what was going on, and then finding a time. All good. But this is the interview which is the most degraded, and so will require a few more punch-ins from me to explain areas where I had to delete a whole swathes of audio. I'm sorry to you, the listener, and also sorry to David that the recording doesn't always do him justice. With all those apologies done, let's dive into the show. Welcome to David Petts, an early medieval specialist and our third interview with an archaeologist. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to All Bones.
Yes, well, I'm David Petts. I'm an associate professor in archaeology at the Department of Archaeology at Durham, where I've been nearly 12 years now. I've been there quite a while now. And I mainly work on the early medieval period, so 5th, 10th centuries AD. That's my particular kind of stand ground on the whole. And I work on early medieval religion.
David also mentioned, in an area lost to the bad connection, that he's also fascinated by 20th century archaeology. Archaeology is often used as a term to mean something ancient, but that's not the case. Archaeo means old or the past, and ology means to study, so archaeology is anything involved with studying the past. Some people take this to extremes by excavating landfills, which are still in use today. That is a smelly but enjoyable and rhetorical way to illustrate the point that archaeology isn't just really old things. However, that rhetoric hides the fundamental fact that there is a lot of exciting archaeology focusing on modern periods, and most notably the 20th century. A lot happened in the first 50 years of the 1900s, two world wars, a couple of economic crashes, some crazy partying, and many things many people didn't want to talk about. Much of what happened in the 20th century is undocumented. Many archaeologists, for example, excavate World War I battlefields or World War II crash sites to understand what happened when the reports simply read, "This division attacked," or "This plane was shot down over X town." There is more than violence in 20th century archaeology, though. People dig hospitals or stately homes that were abandoned or adapted. There's also a lot of industrial archaeology that spreads from the 19th century into the 20th century. An entertaining way to get a flavour of this more modern archaeology is to watch two episodes of Time Team. One where they dig a Spitfire, and another where they dig a Navvies camp, or the village where the people who Britain's early railways lived. 20th century archaeology is giving us a lot of detail we would miss if we either relied wholly on the written record or waited until the 20th century was genuinely ancient before beginning to dig these sites. But what you're about to hear next is how David fell in love with the early medieval period, and Christianity in particular. He mentioned the thing that grabbed him as a child, and then his time at the University of York.
I don't know. I think of a lot of these things, it is about imaginative engagement. So when I was kind of six or seven, I can remember there was kind of various programs on television about the Dark Age and about, you know, Vikings. And I think as an impressionable kind of seven-year-old, seeing lots of people stamping around with swords and axes, big growling at each other, kind of tickled my imagination. So I've always been interested in the early medieval period. And when I was an undergraduate, I was at York, which was very strong, still is very strong for early medieval archaeology. That consolidated that interest. Why the church? Initially, I wasn't terribly interested in Christianity particularly. Most of my initial interest were more on paganism. But I became increasingly interested in an intellectual sense about how this massive religious change, which goes across, you know, all of Western Europe, Northwestern Europe in the early medieval period, and well beyond Europe as well, how that actually impacted on society. And I think once I got my head around the fact that early medieval Christianity is very different from the kind of later church, it's much more unusual, it's much more distinctive, it's much more alien than perhaps we kind of associate with later Christianity. And I think that kind of that's what really got me going. And my PhD work was on the impact of Christianity on burial rites in places like Wales, early medieval Wales. And I've just stayed doing that stuff ever since, really.
Great. And actually, I think you touched on a couple of things there that I'm keen to dispel early on in the series, which is when people say Christianity, they think of the churches that they know. And when they think of the Dark Ages, they think of Vikings. Could you maybe, like, just to kick us off before we jump into like asking about some of the sites that you've dug out and some more of your actual work, I don't know, like a 30,000 feet view of the period of, you know, I'm focusing on Britain particularly, yeah, and just from that period between the Romans leaving and then 1066. I know that's a huge period.
Okay, I'll give us
the trailer version of it all.
Okay, well, I mean, obviously a key point is the early 5th century when the Roman Empire withdraws its control of Roman Britain. And the precise dates are, you know, the conventional date is AD 410, but that was just part of the process of changes beforehand and continuity afterwards. It's also important to remember that at that point, only half of Britain was under the control of the empire anyway. Hadrian's Wall goes more or less across the middle of Britain, so everything to the north was outside the empire. And that's really important because the tension between the continuity of the Roman Empire and its influence and the impact of areas, cultures to the north are really important, and they play out across the later first millennium AD. When the Romans leave, we have this period of maybe 50 to 100 years, depending precisely where you are, where we have a culture that is a successor to Roman Britain. So most people would have been speaking either Latin or the native British languages, and it's before the Anglo-Saxon migration period. That really kicks off the impact of the Anglo-Saxons. That really starts in the mid-5th century. The timings are subtly changing over time. You know, some of the earlier Anglo-Saxon burials are sneaking even earlier. But broadly speaking, mid-5th century, that's when we start to see the impact of Anglo-Saxon culture. And there's a huge debate across archaeology and history about the extent and nature of Anglo-Saxon immigration. Obviously, the Anglo-Saxons are the people who were based in southern Scandinavia, northern Germany. There's this melting pot, this mix of lots of different tribal groups. And there's a lot of problems with this whole term Anglo-Saxon. I probably won't go into that right now. But we have these Germanic groups who influenced Britain culturally very heavily from the mid-5th century. The traditional story was that this is a mass migration, wiping out and replacing the native British population. That's been increasingly nuanced. At one point, the consensus went right the other way, arguing for a tiny elite migration, and they would just happen to take over. Now the consensus is probably more broadly in the middle, that there was, in some places, quite a large-scale migration, but that's not true of all of England, and the scale and nature and the way in which those Germanic influences played out across what had been Roman Britain vary massively regionally. Meanwhile, to the north, you've got kingdoms which are growing up outside the Roman world, things like the Kingdom of the Picts, which starts really coalescing really in the 4th century, before the Romans leave. We also have the Irish kingdoms southwest Scotland, centred on Argyll, the Kingdom of the Scots. And of course, we have the native British, they remain in control in places like Cornwall and Wales.
So, this one is a brilliant rabbit hole and something we'll have to grapple with a lot next season. Britain, for such a small place, is a patchwork quilt of peoples, ethnicities, and different cultural regions. For a couple of personal examples from England, if I were to drive 20 or 30 miles northwards from my fiancé's parents in Whitney, Oxfordshire, to Stratford-upon-Avon, the home of Shakespeare, just the other side of the Cotswolds, I would pass through two very distinct worlds. At first, I would be in what I guess you could call classic Cotswolds, a region that was extremely rich in the 14th century due to the wool trade. When cotton arrived from the New World and from India, the area dropped into poverty and isolation until wealthy Londoners realised they could live their countryside dreams while remaining less than 2 hours from the city. The buildings are beautiful, made of honey-coloured limestone, and pubs have names like the Plough and the Lamb and Flag. The accents of the old Oxfordshire folk seem related to those of Somerset. However, even while I was still driving through the Cotswolds, the buildings would shift as I moved northwards. The stone changes to weathered red brick. Houses stop having names like Lower Farm and instead become short rows of terraces. Canals begin to appear more often, the world flattens out, and accents sound more and more like those around Birmingham. That is just within one region many people would consider homogenous. In my homeland of Pontefract, Yorkshire, there is a particular accent of which mine is a poor example. Yorkshire's history, you see, is a series of self-contained towns and villages focused on specific industries. For example, where I live, almost every village of any decent size is concentrated on a now-defunct coal mine. Other places, like Glasshoughton, had a special industry, glass. These meant these towns and villages were often self-sufficient and isolated from their neighbours. All of which means, in the tiny 10-mile radius within which I grew up, you can identify people by their accents with remarkable accuracy. There is a Wyrcie accent, a Normanton accent, an Upton accent, a Castleford accent, and in many cases, the places that I'm mentioning aren't just neighbours. They're now contiguous. Britain, despite our current toe-dipping into xenophobia, is and has forever been a diverse place. That patchwork of places have complicated relations with each other. Perhaps best summed up when the ex-Prime Minister, David Cameron, after spending a few weeks politicking Yorkshire, remarked, "We knew the people of Yorkshire didn't like other people, we just didn't realise they hated each other so much as well." Now, some of the posher members of British society kind of flit over these differences and reside in a world where everyone sounds like Hugh Grant and reads Horse and Home. For most of the folk, though, there often was and remains stark differences between places which are cheek and jowl. Now think how significant the differences could be between different countries. Wales is still its own country, and Cornwall is an independent region within the United Kingdom. Each of these places has its own complex history, which is often poorly recorded when compared with that of their big neighbour, England. They are both British, and what we mean by that is that the ancestors of the native Welsh and Cornish are predominantly the same folk who lived in Britain before the arrival of the Romans, the Celtic. We'll get into this a lot more in a few episodes.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I wanted to make it clear just how different Wales and Cornwall are to the rest of the island when you pay attention. All of which leads us to the biggest problem with the term Welsh. That's not what the Welsh call themselves in their native tongue. The difference between the already diverse England in the early medieval period and Wales, which is diverse in its whole own way, was so stark that even back then, it acted as a clear cultural boundary between these two loose groups, which we will obviously discuss in a few episodes' time. The Welsh called themselves the Cymry, and the land east of the Severn, Lloegr, which probably means land of the warriors. The English, kicking off a millennium of poetic inferiority to our Welsh cousins, called the Welsh, well, Welsh, which means foreigners. Cornwall is also pejorative. The Wall in Cornwall has the same roots as Wales and means, like Wales, foreign. The Corn in Cornwall probably means something along the lines of peninsula or headland. So, Wales means foreigner, and Cornwall means foreigners on the peninsula. As I said, the English have always been more prosaic than our Celtic brethren. Why have I rambled on for so long here? Well, for two reasons. The first is that it is extremely important if you are to understand anything about British history, especially early medieval history, that you know the rule is diversity and change, not just between the named countries of the United Kingdom today, but even amongst places which might seem somehow quintessential, whether that is the Cotswolds or the marvellous stereotype, which is very often Yorkshire. The second reason is that terminology is complicated in this period. Whatever language we use will be problematic. Welsh and Cornish are the English terms for folks who are often their foes. They are pejorative. However, I've gone on for too long. We'll come to how we cut through this linguistic knot next episode. Let's get back to David Petts.
So really the story of the 5th to 7th century is the spread of Anglo-Saxon culture. We see potentially political hierarchies and social hierarchies becoming a bit more complicated. And then lots of things happen in the 7th century. That's the next big period of change. We see the impact of Christianity, the Anglo-Saxons starting to convert. The native British had always been Christian. So we see the impact of the church on the Anglo-Saxons. We see the emergence of big kingdoms, so increased social complexity. We see changes in economy and society, so the advent of coinage, the revival of international trade. So an awful lot happens in the 7th century. And from my point of view, that conversion period is really, really exciting. We see the spread of monasticism, building of churches, Anglo-Saxon state sculpture. So everything's kingly. We have these great big Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, places like Northumbria and Mercia and Wessex. They're doing very well economically, socially, politically. And then really in the 9th century, we have the impact of the Vikings. The Vikings start as raiders, attacking very short, sharp raids. But increasingly, they start living or staying more permanently in Britain. They start overwintering. And we go through a good century or more of ongoing Viking presence. So some of us continued raids, but also we see the emergence of Viking Scandinavian political groupings in Britain, particularly in the north, places like Scotland and Northern England and the Midlands. And then finally, as we get that kind of settled down, there'll be the you have a kind of change in the economy, and everything's kind of starting to be a little bit calmer again. And then we have the impact of the Normans, who are really the last of the great Viking raids. Essentially, the Normans are kind of have cultural links with the Vikings. They are basically Vikings who settled in northern France. And then that takes us to 1066 and all that happened after that. And that's, you know, where my kind of research interests fade out with the advent of the Normans. But broadly speaking, we've got these big cultural changes: Anglo-Saxon cultural influence, Viking cultural influence, and then the spread of things like Christianity, which are really important in building those links between early medieval Britain and the wider European world.
Brilliant. Well, I'm glad I got you to do that, because I think you did a better job than I definitely will. That's really good. And I think really glad that you could hit on some of the big debates that we're going to be talking about in the series. You know, the nature of the Anglo-Saxon invasion, the sort of the mirroring of a lot of the themes in, you know, development of urbanization, the development of coinage that you also see at the very end of the late Iron Age and the early Roman period. It sort of disappears and it comes back again. And
one of the reasons I decided to look at the early medieval period after a season on British prehistory was because, on the surface, the early medieval period, especially the 400s to 650s, are in a way a return to British prehistory. Especially between the late Iron Age and early medieval or migration period, it isn't just the archaeological evidence which is similar. A return to wood as the primary building material, an increase in regional diversity, and prosaic everyday life with occasional masterpieces in metalworking. Now, it's also in the themes we will be discussing. For example, where does change come from? Does change flow from a cultural centre to a periphery? Or does change happen organically within a society whose individuals choose to change? What happens when a nation is invaded? Do people acquiesce? Do they resist? Or do they create a third way, joining the two cultures into something new? Or how about another one? Where do towns come from? Are they the result of top-down influence from people like Claudius, Hadrian, and Alfred the Great? Or are they the result of market forces bringing enterprising individuals to the same place until that place becomes fixed and populous? Obviously, the Iron Age and early medieval period are not the same. However, as subjects, they do share similarities. And hopefully, what with me being a more experienced podcaster, I can not only create better episodes for this season, but make the episodes of season one better by making them the start of a larger narrative.
Obviously, we met at Durham in the northeast of England. What is it about the northeast region that can obviously start out in Wales? Is there anything particular about the northeast, or is it just where you get a job?
Well, yeah, exactly. Where you can get a job. That's the way our archaeology works. But I mean, I was an undergraduate at York, so I kind of, a lot of my early exposure to Anglo-Saxon archaeology was from a kind of northern English perspective. What I really like about Northumbria is it's on the border between the Anglo-Saxon world, so in the part of Britain which look kind of Germanic and look towards France and ultimately Italy, but also to the north, it's an area which has lots of links and looks towards the world of the Picts, the world of the British kingdoms in Scotland and Ireland. So it's an interesting cultural zone. It's a border area where we have, yeah, lots of Viking, lots of Anglo-Saxon influence and Viking influence, but also we have Irish and Scottish and Pictish influence as well. So it's a part of the world which looks to the north and west, but also to the south and east. You have all these cultural influences swilling around, which I find absolutely fascinating.
Excellent. And we're going to come on to the Northumbrian Golden Age and Lindisfarne in a moment. But before we do that, I want to go back a little bit. I want to go on a bit of a nostalgia trip for myself to Binchester.
Yeah.
Tell everybody a little bit about what Binchester is and what it is that attracted you to dig there.
Binchester, Binchester, Binchester. If you're a loyal listener, you'll have heard me mention Binchester a lot recently. My imminent move to Oxford has got me nostalgic for my early days when I learned to dig. I'll leave it to David to explain exactly what Binchester is, but I do want to mention a couple of things. The first is that Roman forts are more than just forts, which is something we don't dive into in this conversation. We will talk about this a little bit more in season 2 when we discuss the end of the Roman period. But essentially, in the north of England especially, Roman forts are acting in a comparable fashion to the Roman towns further south. They're the nexus, not just for imperial control, i.e. the fort, but also for civilian activity. In the north of England, the Roman army was the biggest economic force, and the army relied on a complex system to support themselves, much of which rested on the shoulders of the local people. Northerners, being an enterprising bunch, took advantage of this, and around every town we find viki, small settlements where the families of the soldiers lived, as did many people providing services to the army, like merchants, metal workers, restaurants, taverns, and, of course, brothels. Secondly, though, Binchester was a field school. And if this podcast has got you interested in learning about archaeology, and especially the practical dirt permanently under your fingernails kind of archaeology, then I would really recommend going to a field school. Many archaeological sites have a field school, and David Petz is involved with Dig Ventures, who run archaeological excavations and put training new archaeologists at the heart of everything they do. I've included a link in the show notes. I actually went on one of their virtual courses during the lockdown. It was highly enjoyable, as is their Facebook community. They don't sponsor me, although I'd love that. I just wanted to mention them as a great way if you want to get involved in archaeology.
Yeah, well, Binchester, it's a Roman fort, and it lies about 10 miles south of Durham. So it's about 30 miles south of Hadrian's Wall. And when people think about the Romans in the north of Britain, they tend to think of Hadrian's Wall itself. There was this whole network of forts to the north and to the south. Binchester is one of the forts to the south, and it stood on the main road between York, which is the military headquarters, and Hadrian's Wall. There's a large Roman cavalry fort there, and like a lot of Roman forts, it also attracted a civilian settlement, and there's also cemeteries, and there's a whole lot of Roman archaeology going on there. So my involvement with Binchester actually started before I worked at Durham University. Before I worked in academia, I'd spent 4 or 5 years working in local government as a local government archaeologist in the northeast of England. So I'd spent a lot of time at Durham County Council, who owned Roman Fort at Binchester. And it's this huge, big, open field. Some people who might be familiar with places like Halstead and the Hadrian's Wall forts will think of these forts as having always exposed walls. But Binchester is just a big grassy field with some humps and bumps in it. And the archaeologists had barely scratched the surface. So when I started at Durham, one of my first jobs was to come up with a project where we could train our students how to do field archaeology. And because I knew Binchester, there's practical reasons, it was close. Roman archaeology is great for teaching students. We set up a project. Although it wasn't my main kind of research interest in terms of Romans, it actually turned out to be a fascinating site, and we spent 8 years digging there.
Yeah, because correct me if I'm wrong, and if I am wrong, I'll just delete this bit out, but there's a lot of stuff in Binchester also around the late Roman period, wasn't there? There was some really interesting stuff about coming out about the very end of the Roman occupation.
Yeah, Binchester is great because we ended up finding some quite interesting late Roman and early medieval material. Now, that's not something we could have guaranteed when he went into the project. And when he went into the project, the focus was going to be the Roman. But in recent years, more and more work on Hadrian's Wall forts and Roman forts in the north had shown that there was this presence of a very late Roman, early medieval activity at a lot of sites. The trouble is, in the past, when you go back into the 50s and 60s, archaeological techniques weren't as good, and these early medieval features are often very ephemeral. So in the past, they'd kind of been missed. But as techniques develop, we're starting to be able to catch them much better. So when we went into Binchester, right from the very beginning, we were always aware that there might be this early medieval, very late Roman phase. We weren't guaranteed it. We were lucky, but actually it did turn out we got some really interesting early medieval stuff. But yeah, 50 years ago, they wouldn't have picked it up just because techniques had changed so much.
And just on that, this is not a planned question, but it's something that I was reading about and just interested in your thoughts. I think it was a Francis Pry book, Britain AD, that I was reading, and he sort of contrasted places like Yeavering and some of the sites, the larger sort of post-Roman sites in the south, with some of the Hadrian's Wall hill forts. And be interested to know his sort of argument was that they were potentially sent, basically the Roman soldiers remained on and became almost like mafiosa sort of paid for protection sort of troops paid for by the local people, which then became centers for elite control based around a warrior elite. Just interested to get your hot take, I guess, or your take on
yeah.
Does that fit with your experience? Is that a similar thing at Binchester, where these forts are remaining as, like, if not elite centres, then focuses for post-Roman community?
Yes and no. I mean, to a certain, obviously one of the big problems is that that model only works in areas where you have Roman forts. So once you get north of Hadrian's Wall, we have to look for other models of social change. I think it does work for the 5th century. I think you can imagine you have Roman soldiers, they're based at a fort. Pay stopped coming in. To a certain extent, already they were off.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Getting paid in kind of in kind through food and taxation. But once the Roman state and its systems collapse, you have a group of soldiers, they're stabbed in the north of England. It's their home. You know, their families are there. There's nowhere else to go. So if you have a group of people who are experienced fighters with swords, and on horseback, it's not a big leap for them to start kind of extorting food and kind of food products from the local area. So in many ways, it makes sense that what had been a Roman military thing becomes is what's termed the officer to warlord model. They essentially become local warlords. In the past, they would have had a hierarchy going above them. But with the end of the Roman Empire, the higher the buck stops at the local fort commander. So that's that kind of works. What's interesting, though, is if you look in the slightly longer term, once you get into the kind of 6th and 7th century, is actually how few forts continue to remain centres. So, yeah, there's certainly a lot of these sites. But we don't really, once you get into the 6th century, we're not really sure what that activity is. You know, a lot of the things we find at these sites, they would be as comfortable as a small local farm as an elite power centre. And actually, when you look at Binchester, for example, Binchester doesn't become a medieval village. It doesn't even become a parish. If anything, the focus of power moves about 3 or 4 miles, or 2 miles down the road to South Church, Auckland, which seems to be the early medieval power centre. The warlord model works for the 5th century, but it gets increasingly problematic the later you go.
It seems to be that this entire period is, as soon as you get one model, it only lasts for a little period, and then, or it only lasts for a particular region, then it changes and changes again. It's what dragged me to it, actually, after doing a bit of the British prehistory stuff to kick off, I kept finding myself being dragged to this period just because you can sort of take any region of the UK, and it's a completely different story a lot of the time.
There's huge amount of regional variation. You know, what's going even within a single kingdom. So what's going on in central Northumberland is different from what's going on in County Durham, which is different from Yorkshire, and they're all part of the same kingdom of Northumbria. And again, it's different once you get north of the wall. So even though you have these things which are politically unified, socially, culturally, economically, they remain very fragmented.
Let's move on a little bit in time, because I know that one of your main research areas at the moment is Lindisfarne, which is, if anybody's got a passing interest in this period, is a name that immediately sparks excitement and interest. Could you give us a potted history of the island of Lindisfarne, the Holy Island, and also your involvement and what you're researching there?
Yeah, well, Lindisfarne is a small tidal island off the northeast coast of Northumberland, so it's about 15 miles south of the Scottish border. It has its importance as one of the most substantial and powerful early medieval monasteries in Britain, really. It was founded in 635. It was by the Anglo-Saxon king Oswald. He's just fought a battle, fought some wars to take up power. His uncle, who'd been the most powerful Northumbrian king beforehand, was King Edwin. And Edwin was the first king of Northumbria to convert to Christianity. Oswald was also Christian, but he'd converted to Christianity when he'd been in exile in Ireland. Edwin had been converted by monks from France and by links with Anglo-Saxon Kent. But yeah, Oswald converts, but in a different context. So he converts to an Irish tradition of Christianity. And he probably converted at Iona, which is a major sort of Irish-influenced Scottish monastery. So when Oswald takes up power, he comes back to Northumbria with some monks from Iona, and they found this monastery on the island. And it becomes a major monastery. It has lots of patronage from the kings of Northumbria. It becomes increasingly important. Northumbria goes through these big kind of religious changes in the later 7th century, because we have this problem where some of the Christians in Northumbria are Irish influenced and some are Anglo-Saxon influenced, and they have lots of differences. They celebrate Easter at different times. They have other doctrinal differences. So what happens is another Anglo-Saxon king, Oswy, he holds a big church council, and they decide whether they're going to be Irish Christians or Anglo-Saxon Christians, essentially, and they go with the Anglo-Saxon church. And that's really important, because it means the monks from Iona leave Lindisfarne, and a new guy is brought in, a guy called St. Cuthbert. He's not a saint at the time, but he comes in as a new head of the priory. He has a reputation for being a holy man, and when he dies, that's the best thing he could possibly have done for Lindisfarne, because that gives them a new saint. And when you have a saint, you have relics, you have pilgrims, they bring in gifts, they bring in money, they make donations of land. So Lindisfarne becomes incredibly powerful. And it's around that time that Lindisfarne Gospels, these amazing manuscripts, are created. And until the 9th century, Lindisfarne remains an incredibly powerful monastic site with lots and lots of land, lots and lots of daughter houses. There was the impact of the Vikings, and to cut the long story short, most of the monks from Lindisfarne, they leave. It's a bit more complicated than that. They move around the north of England before finally ending up in Durham at the end of the first millennium AD, and that really marked the emergence of Durham as a town, and that's why St. Cuthbert is now buried in Durham. So it's a site which has got lots of links with Durham. It's somewhere I'd always taken students. It's always been obviously very much on my intellectual horizons. In terms of fieldwork, I've been bogged down with Binchester for a long time. But as I got towards the end of Binchester, I was looking for new fieldwork opportunities. I wanted to do something which was more focused on my own work. And I've done the Lindisfarne project with some collaborators from a great organisation called Dig Ventures, who work on community archaeology and crowdfunding. I've known the guys there for quite some time, and as a lot of things in archaeology happen, conversations in pubs, kind of idle pipe dreams turn into something a bit more solid. And since 2016, we've been running the project jointly on the island, looking at the remains of the Anglo-Saxon monastery.
Great. And what the So you're looking specifically for the Anglo-Saxon monastery. What are the big research aims of the project?
In terms of our first big research aim was to actually find the Anglo-Saxon monastery. We had a broad sense of where it probably was, but Lindisfarne has seen surprisingly little archaeological work. Somewhere like Iona in Western Scotland, that's been cut to ribbons by archaeologists, to be honest. places like Monk Wearmouth and Jarrow, which are the big Northumbrian monasteries, they've been heavily excavated, but Lindisfarne had only seen, certainly seen less work, a little bit, but not much. So our first job was to locate some seriously and clearly early medieval remains, which we've done. At the moment, my key things I'm interested in are how much activity continued on site after the Viking raids. That's something I'm particularly interested in, because the traditional story is that everybody left. And you know, increasingly clear that quite a few people stayed. We're also interested in the community, the people who lived there. And luckily, we've got a cemetery, so that's going to give us lots of opportunity to look at the burials and the bones of the people there. And we're interested more generally in the kind of monastic landscape, the monasteries. These big, important Anglo-Saxon and early medieval monasteries were huge. They were really big sites. So the later ruins of the monastery, of the high medieval monastery at Lindisfarne, are quite compact. But the early medieval monastery probably underlies most of the village. And it was part of an even bigger landscape exploitation of religious and ritual use of the wider landscape. So we're starting to look at that increasingly as the project develops.
Great. And just on that point about Lindisfarne being a tidal island, could you explain to me, could you tell the audience a little bit more about the strange nature of monasticism in the medieval period, whereby like places like Iona and Lindisfarne and other places, they tend to be out of the way places or on islands, which seem at first to be quite a, you know, odd decision, especially with what happens in the 9th century.
Yeah, one of the things that's really distinctive about a lot of the early medieval monasticism in Britain is they're really exploiting islands, they're exploiting coastal locations. And I think there's two reasons for that. First of all, in early monasticism, not just in Britain, but more generally, there was this idea that monks are meant to be somewhere out of the way, a little bit sort of remote. A lot of the early monasteries in places like Egypt were actually in the desert. So you know, there's this sense that they're on, by being on the coast, they're kind of on the edge of the world. But I think one can overemphasize that, because it's also important to remember that the Anglo-Saxons and the Scots, the Picts, these are maritime people. So actually, they're using the coasts and shipping as key communication routes. So actually, they're places like Lindisfarne, these amazingly paradoxical places. They're both on the edge. They're not the kind of places where major Anglo-Saxon secular power centres were on the whole. So they have that sense of being on the edge. At the same time, they're also quite close to major communication corridors. So anybody moving up and down the coast of Northumberland would have literally seen a monastery. Yeah, more or less, if you sailed the whole length to the coast of Northumbria from the Firth of Forth all the way down to the Humber, it's very rarely you'd ever be out of sight of a significant Anglo-Saxon monastery. So there this tension between remoteness and being in the centre of things, yeah.
Which also brings me to another tension with monasticism in the Anglo-Saxon period, which is, you mentioned St. Cuthbert, obviously famously an extremely holy man, but also the fact that the monastery was founded by Oswald and then patronised by Oswiu and other Anglo-Saxon kings of Northumbria. And could you talk a little bit about how that combination of secular and religious power and how the role of monasteries in that sort of weird sort of not quite fully religious, not quite fully secularized politically?
Yeah, I mean, one of the important things you need to really think about is when in this period when people are founding monasteries and setting up monasteries is the simplest. If you're going to build a monastery, you need land. You need land to build your monastery on, and you need land to feed the monks. And how do you get that land? In Anglo-Saxon society, on the whole, most land was held in common by families. So it's not like one individual can just give land to a monastery, because lots of other people have claims on that land. Yeah, your brothers and your children and your uncles, they'll all have claims on that land. The one person who does have the ability to give away land, essentially, are kings. So kings and monasteries are always closely linked in this period, because it's the kings who are able to give land to the monks to set up monasteries. Then this means you get a very close relationship between monks and monasteries and kings. The kings give the monks some certain kind of what are essentially tax breaks. You don't have to pay the same kind of renders and tributes that normal people would have to in Anglo-Saxon world. In return, the monks are providing all sorts of things. They're providing kind of symbolic and ideological support for the kings, praying for the kings. Also, it's a world where literacy is just coming back. So it's a lot of the bureaucrats. This is a world where kingdoms are getting much, much bigger. So if you're going to run a big kingdom, you start to need a bureaucracy and people to run it. So we have this very kind of close relationship between monks and kings. Now, not surprisingly, as monasteries acquire a lot of land, they become big and they become wealthy. And throughout this period and throughout monasticism more generally, you've always seen this tension between monasteries acquiring a lot of land and important monks starting to live like secular aristocrats. At the same time, there's always been this strong thread within the monastic tradition, which emphasizes poverty and living a humble and simple life. And you see that in Anglo-Saxon writers. They talk about churches becoming centers of people living luxurious lives. And there's lots of good cautionary stories about people, nuns wearing too much jewelry, and then suffering diseases and raids and attacks and things because they were lived such a non-Christian life. People like St. Cuthbert was one of the most important church people in Northumbria. He was a confidant of kings. Yet at the same time, he also had this urge to spend time as a hermit on one of the islands off Lindisfarne. So again, there's always this kind of dialogue between a worldly church and a more unworldly church going on through the Anglo-Saxon and early medieval period.
Great, and it's actually that's one of the themes that I'm really looking forward to exploring that in this next season is that strange relationship that seems a little bit out of kilter at first when we think of Christianity, especially sticking with Lindisfarne just for a little bit longer. I think I can talk a lot in the podcast about the theory about what's going on. I can tell the stories, but my knowledge of excavation and fieldwork is limited. So I'd love for you to give the listeners a flavour of what it's like, not just to dig at a site, but to dig at a site like Lindisfarne, which is tidal, which has a community living on it, which is unfortunately for the weather in the northeast of England. So it's it can be a bit of a tough place to dig, I can imagine. So talking about some of the practicalities of digging at a place like Lindisfarne.
Yeah, well, it's the most remarkable place I've ever dug. I mean, first of all, it's an incredibly picturesque place. It's an amazing place. Our trench sits right next to the later monastic ruins, but looks out across the where our trenches are. We can look across Lindisfarne, the castle on the island. We're looking across to the Farne Islands a little bit further away. It's a beautiful sight, and even when the weather's a bit grim, which it can be, it's still an absolutely stunning place to work. It's a very strange place because it's tidal, and still today the only way to get on the island is when the tide is out, so you can drive on, and when the tide comes in, you can't get on the island. And obviously the tides change every day, so every day is different because it's a quite touristy place. So what you tend to get these sudden influxes of people coming in with the tides, and then they all leave when the tides come in again. So you get these moments of incredible hectic, people everywhere. Our trench is next to a footpath and loads of people talking to us. And then suddenly it can be the middle of the day and everyone disappears and you're more or less by yourself with just looking at the local people. And again, in the evenings when the tourists go, the island's kind of our own little kingdom, and there's an amazing wildlife. There's beaches. It might be north of England, but it's still warm enough to go swimming and stuff in the summer. So it's a really phenomenal place to work. You know, we all stay on the island, which I think makes it such a it's what makes the project for me, because when you're doing a project like this, it's as much about what you're doing when you're not digging.
Oh, you make me very jealous. None of you have got so bored out there that you've started to do a Cuthbert and start talking to the seals, have you?
Not yet, but you do hear the seals. And that's the thing, the seals, loads of seals around there, and they all lie on the sandbanks and they just kind of moan and groan at night. It's so quiet. You lie in bed and you just hear these groaning seals. It's absolutely remarkable.
Does the potential marketability of places like Lindisfarne and Binchester and working with people like Dick Grenches from remote archaeology, does that play a role? Is that an important role for you? A part of any project for you is how are you going to actually communicate this to the public?
Yeah, it's a key part of what we do now. And I imagine doing any serious fieldwork now, which doesn't involve the community or the public in some way. I mean, someone like Lindisfarne, and what drove me there was the intellectual research thing. But you can't, someone like that, it's such a high profile site, you can't do archaeology there without engaging with the public, because it's such a loved site. It has so many visitors. We have a huge number of people who just follow us remotely, or with the crowdfunding model as well, we have people who put money into the project. They may never even ever get to go to the island, but they become emotionally invested in it. And I think the money they put into the project is a reflection of that emotional investment. And I think, you know, more widely is this archaeology is so important to people. Historical identity is so important. And I think people increasingly realise that archaeology is not something in an academic ivory tower. And I think we've got a lot of things to thank for that. We've got things like Time Team, which I think is incredibly important in demystifying archaeology. It may have meant that archaeology wasn't all about digging, you know, amazing, stunning sites with loads of gold or something exotic. It showed people that even, you know, a relatively small project in the back of someone's village, finding just a couple of stretches of wall, it showed that that was exciting and was interesting, and that, you know, it wasn't all about the gold and the spectacular things. It was just about knowledge. That was really important. And then things like the advent of the Heritage Lottery around the turn of a century, that was really important as well, because that meant there's lots of money available for local groups to set up and get involved with archaeology. So Britain has this phenomenal network and community of people who are amateur but engaged archaeologists. And I think we actually forget how unique that is. We've kind of grown quite used to that in Britain. But, you know, there's nothing comparable really elsewhere in Europe. It's not really the same kind of situation in the States either. We're incredibly lucky that we have this really thriving amateur and community sector, where the professionals and the amateurs on the whole work really well together.
So in this bit, I basically asked why the early medieval period wasn't very popular. And I just want to explain why I asked that question in a little bit more detail. Because some of you might be saying, really? What about shows like The Last Kingdom or Vikings or the whole heap of computer games set in the early medieval period? All of which are good points, so I thought I'd best clarify. The early medieval period can be further divided up into two periods. One of these, the earlier period, is what you might think of as the Dark Ages. The later period often gets called the Viking Age or the late Anglo-Saxon period. The period I was referring to here is the period from the fall of Rome to the later 800s, when Alfred and the Vikings appear on the scene. That period of Alfred and the Vikings and later on the Normans does have good representation in the media and public consciousness. That earlier period, though, well, for most folks, it's still a period filled with myth and misunderstanding. During this time, what was actually happening was the face of Britain was changing forever. The Germanic Anglo-Saxons were arriving and blending with or pushing out the Celtic Britons, depending on how violent you like your history. An array of different communities and kingdoms developed. Over time, these gave birth to kingdoms like Northumbria, Mercia, Wessex, East Anglia, etc. During this period, you also had the Northumbrian Golden Age when Bede was writing. You also had bloodthirsty and fascinating kings like Penda, Oswald and Offa. You also had men like St. David and St. Patrick walking the countryside on the front line of a sometimes very real war between the pagan Anglo-Saxons and the Christian Britons. So, during this period, there are stories of migration, of religious war, of identities, changing kingdoms arising. There is a complex political environment filled with larger-than-life, semi-heroic figures. In other words, during this period of prestige TV, ideal source material. And yet, all we really get from this period is poorly made takes on the story of King Arthur, who, while I love the stories of King Arthur, is unfortunately a poor poster boy for how brilliant this period really was. I think there must be a market for more material about this odd but fascinating time period, and it's a shame that the powers that be haven't seen fit to agree with me just yet.
I think it's a number of problems. I mean, there are some notable exceptions when you think about the Staffordshire Horde, which you know, when you get these amazing hordes, sites like Sutton Hoo, I think they do grab people. I think one of the troubles is the archaeology is not very easy. Roman sites, you have walls, you have loads of finds. I mean, Winchester, we had 3 tons of pottery by the end of it. Very easy to talk about. You know, when people come to site, you can point people, you say, there's a wall, they can see it, they can see the objects. With an early medieval sites, the sites are often very ephemeral. Unless you've got a cemetery where you've got grave goods, most Anglo-Saxon sites have very, or early medieval sites have very few finds. The buildings are wooden, so they're not easy to visualise on site when you're describing people, when you're describing it to them. It presents quite an interpretative challenge, I think. So you know, the exceptions are graves, the occasional hoard, and I think the thing with the hoards, they tend to be found by metal detectorists rather than archaeologists. So again, that keys into a different narrative about treasure, which is, and monetary value, which is always something which I feel a bit uneasy about. So it is tricky, but you do get places like, I mean, I'm sitting here in York at the moment. We've got the Viking Centre here, and that's a case where an early medieval site did produce amazing stuff and really keyed in popular imagination. But that's because they had really unusual finds preservation, because they had always wooden objects. And it's when you see a site like that with all the you realise that most objects they had were wood or organic, and you realise how much we've lost on normal early medieval sites. So I think that's perhaps why it's harder for people to get into. And what's interesting is that the biggest popular engagements with early medieval archaeology or the early medieval period, I think, are the TV series The Vikings and The Last Kingdom. And that's because they're fiction, because they're drama, you can populate, you can build the buildings, you can dress people, and that kind of steps in and fills the gap that perhaps you have with the actual archaeology itself.
This was really, really frustrating. The audio had settled down, things were going well, and then just as David Petz was giving me some fantastic answers to my last few questions, the recording, unbeknownst to me, stopped. Oh yes, the conversation kept going. It kept going for another 15 minutes, but none of it was recorded. So unfortunately, that's the end of this conversation. More than any other guest, I want to thank David for his time. He was patient while I figured out how to do these interviews and gave me a lot more of his time than I asked for. I think we can learn a lot from that episode. I loved hearing about the Christians who were climbing the Himalayas at the same time as their brethren were wrestling with seals on the Northumbrian coast. It was also, for obvious reasons, fascinating to me to hear about the decisions behind Binchester as a site to excavate. Also, who can't find the idea of swimming with seals just wonderful? The main lesson, though, is test your equipment and systems before you use them. I feel like I've done David an injustice with this episode. We should have had better audio, a less over-keen interviewer trying to impress a mentor, and a system which didn't decide to stop recording halfway through. That, my friends, is one of the main reasons why this show is a predominantly host-only, narrative-driven show. It's so much easier to control. Which is what we will be back to next month. In September, we'll have the last of these in-between series specials, our introduction to the early medieval period. We're going to set the scene, introduce some themes, and throw down some disclaimers in what I'm sure will be a fun and informative episode. Before we close out today, I want to say a big thank you to Justin, who's just joined the Patreon community this month, and to Amanda, who rejoined after a short hiatus. As you'll know from last month, money is a slight concern as I start at Oxford, so those of you who join our growing community are extremely welcome. Thank you to all. I did ask the group if this month had they had any questions, and I had no takers. So instead, look, these questions and answers are something new that I'm trying as a perk for patrons. So please let me know if you like these. If you don't, tell me how I could improve those, how I could improve the show, improve anything. This show is a solo host-driven thing, but I don't like the idea of it springing forth in my brain and my brain only. I want to hear what the people want. I want to talk about things you care about, and I'll make sure you're having your questions answered. The best way to have your say on the show's direction is, of course, to become a patron. But you can also find my email in the show notes or join the community on Facebook or Instagram. So this is, as I say, a solo show. So when you DM me or send me an email, it comes straight to my inbox. And anyway, that seems like a grand place to stop today. Thank you all for listening. And I hope you have a great day. I'm Andy Erdshaw, and this is Old Bones.